A small disclaimer on today's episode, OMC crew, as this was my first international recording with a renowned guest, and thank you very much for his time in advance. There were some small technical difficulties which may have resulted in parts having to be re-recorded after the fact. If you sense any sort of aberrations or things that don't quite match up, we've done our best to recreate the bits that were lost, and I think we've done a stellar job. Thank you for your patience, and on with the show. Locked in the bunker, shadow shaking. One man clapping secrets awake. Board games living, dice they break. Echoes pounding, hearts they quake. Welcome to the sound of one man clapping. I am the one man coming to you direct from the bunker today, bringing you the first in our Not All Heroes Wear Capes series, where I bring to you, the listener, the origin stories for board gaming's most notable contributors. And I think it would be nigh on impossible to dispute that as far as high quality, consistent, and valuable content goes, there are few that can match that of Paul Grogan and his YouTube channel Gaming Rules. Paul, a spectacularly warm welcome to one man clapping.
Thank you very much for having me.
Paul, when I started this podcast in October of last year, I did so with a clear vision of where I wanted to go. And telling the origin stories of this hobby's vanguard, those who gave it life and breath, was one of my personal mandates. I actually reached out to you several months ago, right at the beginning of this, inquiring by email if you'd be interested and willing to be interviewed. And you, despite your aggressive schedule, you know, as a consumer of your content, I have some small insight into how busy you are, if only by noting how prolific your output is. You came back to me within minutes. I don't think I'd finished typing my second request out for potential guests, and you'd already come back with a resounding absolutely, which was amazing.
And that's the unusual thing, is that, yes, I am busy, and everybody knows that I'm really busy and I'm always behind on my work and everything else. And yet, how did I reply within minutes? That tells a lot about my personality. I'm busy working. I've got a deadline. I'm trying to get this thing done. And bing, oh, there's an email. Oh, well, I'll just reply to that now. Because if I don't reply to that now, it'll get left.
So without too much further preamble, I do want to hark back just a little bit to a segment you did quite a while ago, probably a few months back, about Undaunted 2200 Callisto. Not sure if you remember that particular video, but you were dialing in David Thompson.
Oh, that one. Oh, the unboxing video. Yes. Yes.
And whether it was pre-planned or not is, you know, we don't need to see behind the scenes, but you got him on the line.
Yes.
And the very first thing you said was, David, it's Paul, we're live on the channel, no swearing. And I just wanted to say that if it were to happen that you were so effusively ebullient about something as we reminisce, it would be perfectly okay if a very small curse word snuck out.
Okay. It very likely won't. I very, very rarely swear. So, yeah, it probably won't. But
so I guess without further ado, I'll lead straight in. What I'd like to know first, Paul, is what was your first truly special board game memory? Something that stands out in your history, your personal history, whatever it might be, as the first moment that you can recall where board games made a difference in your life?
Yeah, I mean, this is a great question because I've been interviewed a lot over the last X number of years, and some of the questions that you're going to ask me later on, I have probably been asked before. This one, I haven't. And actually, my first special board game memory goes back to a time before there is a big hole in my mind. So there's a many, many years of my life where I actually don't remember very much about it. But one special board game memory I do have is at home. It was in the late 70s and I was sat there on my own trying to play a board game called Spy Ring. And if you don't know Spy Ring, look it up on Board Game Geek. It is a game from the 70s and it is a game where you have little spies and they move around the board and they're doing spy-y type stuff. Now, I grew up as a kid loving spies, loving James Bond, loving that kind of thing. And I also dabbled...
Yeah, I watched Wild Wild West on Sunday morning.
Right. yes, and I the reason why it sticks in my mind is that I clearly had a love of board games when I was a kid. Now, I was an only child growing up, so I did a lot of stuff on my own. Now, you can't play these games solo, but I obviously dabbled. I obviously multi-handed it, which is ironically, not something that I'm really able to do now. And I probably wasn't even playing it, but I have such a vivid memory of this game. It's got little plastic pieces and there's holes in the heads. And what you do is whenever you activate your radio, you stick this little tiny, probably like a lead thing, and you shove it in the top as the aerial. And that shows that that spy is transmitting. And then if an enemy spy spots them when they've got their aerial up, they get caught and things like that. So yeah, it's a weird memory. It was probably like 1977, 1978 or something like this. And I just have this memory of being at home and playing it.
Amazing. Spy Ring.
Spy Ring.
I'll have to look it up.
Yes.
Do you still have it?
No. I've no idea where that copy would have gone. Because, yeah, that was quite a while ago.
Fair enough. I guess my next question for you, Paul, is, was there a special board game person, somebody who introduced you to board gaming early on that you went down the rabbit hole with? Or was there a group of people? Was there someone who brought you in and you went right in both feet with?
Yeah, I can't answer this question directly because I don't know if there is one specific person. And I'll try not to get too distracted, but my general flow of life and how I got to where I was here. So I grew up loving board games as a kid. And the ones that I played as a kid were, you know, Spy Ring and Cluedo and Monopoly and things like that. And generally, I think I always tried to sort of play them myself, but I probably played them with family as well. Always grew up loving fantasy, sci-fi and everything else. And then in 1982 or 1983, I think it was, a local bookshop got in a book called The Warlock of Firetop Mountain, which was the first fighting fantasy novel by Steve Jackson and Sir Ian Livingstone. And that changed my life because that was a fantasy book where I was the hero and I could play this game. And the friends that I had at the time, we all got this game and we were all playing it. And very, very soon after, at roughly the same time, our group of 12, 13-year-olds bought a copy of Basic Dungeons & Dragons. This was in the red box in the early 80s, and we got that, and we got into role-playing games. Role-playing games was my main thing for about 25 years. I actually stopped playing role-playing games about 15, 16 years ago, but that was my main hobby for a very, very long time. I then did a lot of CCGs, Magic the Gathering in the late 90s and various other ones, but it was about 90, and I dabbled a bit with board games here and there, but role-playing games was still the primary thing until Magic the Gathering took over. And then it was in the late 90s, so it was probably 98-ish that I'd got disillusioned with Magic, got totally fed up with it, and decided I was going to quit the hobby. Now, thankfully for me, the local Magic the Gathering games group that I went to every Tuesday night, there was a group of people in the corner playing board games. So it was probably 16 or so people, 12 to 16 people playing Magic the Gathering, and about four or five people in the corner playing board games. And I decided, I don't want to do this anymore, so I'm going to go and do that. I had dabbled, I'd played Settlers of Catan, and I've played, you know, and I remember going back in the 80s, I played Axis and Allies, I played 1830, I played Civilization. Civilization was my favourite game, played Merchants of Venus. So a lot of the old Avalon Hill games I dabbled with. But then it was in the late 90s where I went, right, I'm going to go cold turkey on Magic. I'm going to get rid of that. Don't want to play that anymore. I'm going to get into the board games. Now, I still did the role-playing games at the time, but then when I moved away from Hertfordshire and I moved down to where I now live in the southwest of England, the role-playing game stopped, and it's been 100% or 99% board games since then. And then, of course, I formed the channel and everything else. So there isn't, there's various stages of my life, and there isn't one board game person that I chose to get into the hobby with and went down the rabbit hole with. Really, there's the group of friends that I had where we all got into Basic Dungeons & Dragons. Then there was a couple of people who I got together with when I started to get into the Magic the Gathering. Then there's my old role-playing groups over the last, you know, 30, 40 years. But when I made that shift to board games, that was a conscious choice of mine. And you could say that the group of people that were playing board games, you know, at that local club kind of helped me into it. But I'd already been aware of these things. I just got really, really into it. And then went to Essen for the first time. I think it was 99. And yeah, it's been nonstop since then.
Amazing. I was very passionate about role-playing myself. I think I had that same red box. Did you find it was a very hard decision to step away from RPGs at the time?
It was.
RPGs, they become your whole life, really.
Yeah. It was because I moved from Hertfordshire down to Somerset at the time. So before I moved, I was running two weekly D&D groups. We were playing D&D 3.5, and wow. I ran two weekly groups. I was the GM, and what I did, I was basically running the same campaign for both groups, because otherwise the prep time would have been insane.
Absolutely. Two campaigns at once, that's a huge commitment.
Yeah, and I used to put way too much work into prepping adventures that it would probably take me, two or three days of prep time in order to do that. And then when I moved down to the Southwest, in order to be near my partner, who is now my wife, I realized that this is not going to fit. I'm not going to have the time to do this. And I was enjoying the board game so much that it was a kind of a conscious decision to say, I'm gonna leave that now, because I'm gonna give myself more time to do board game stuff. So I miss it now and again, but not enough to go back into it.
So that was about 10, 12 years ago, yeah?
15, we moved down here in 2007 is when I moved down to Somerset. So it would have been 2007. So what's that, 17 years now? Or 18 now,
I used to play quite a bit.
Yeah.
But I was more a Shadowrun guy.
Oh, I am with you on Shadowrun, and it is one of the games that I wish I would have played instead of D&D. Because as much as I liked D&D and the fantasy, the Shadowrun setting for me seemed like probably the one that suited me the most.
Yep, that cyberpunk dystopian...
But with trolls and orcs and magic as well.
Absolutely, and rifles.
Yeah.
So my next question is, can you remember a time when board games didn't underpin pretty much everything in your life? Is there a time when board games just weren't the be-all and end-all and were everything that sort of...
No. There you go, next question.
Next.
Well, I mentioned earlier that, you know, when I was, you know, a 7 or 8 year old kid, I was at home playing various board games on my own. So it's always been there. It's obviously there more now than it was then. But sure. Some kind of gaming has always been there in my life.
Yeah, you're a gamer or you're a gamer. There's no in between. I absolutely get that. Well, I guess that leads naturally onto my next question, and the question that I know a lot of listeners are going to be very keen to have the answer to is, you know, what were the catalysts that led to gaming rules? You know, how did you get from spiring to gaming rules, and what happened in between, and where did it all begin?
The story is an interesting one, and I do actually get a lot of people who are, I'm not going to say jealous or envious, but want to be in the position that I'm in. And I understand that, you know, if I was a board gamer and I was just excited about board gaming, and there's this guy who's turned it into a job and it's what he does for a job and he gets paid to do it. Well, I want to do that. You know, I've got to go to this 9 to 5, got to wear an office suit. I don't want to do that kind of thing. So I would be envious of me if I was on the other side of the fence. So I do get asked quite a lot, how do I get to where you are?
Yeah. But I think for me, if I could just interject, I don't want to be where you are. And I'm being perfectly honest.
Right.
I can't think for me of anything worse than doing what you do, to be honest.
Okay.
And by that I mean, what you do with gaming rules is a sacrifice. You know, gaming rules, it's not for you. It's for me. It's for us. You don't get to play necessarily the games you want to play when you want to play. And for me, I think that would be too hard. I think for me, I want to play the games I want to play when I want to play them. And it's really important to me that sort of happens on that timeline. I couldn't do what you do, to be honest.
Right.
And I'm grateful that you do what you do. But for me, I would not want to do that as my job. I've been lucky enough to do something I love for a job my whole life. I'm a chef by trade, and I make people happy with food. But, you know, board gaming for me, it's almost a kind of therapy. And I really appreciate what it brings to my life. But I can imagine, you know, you have to play what's in the queue. You are commissioned to do certain things. You're being paid to do sponsored content, and it's not always up to you.
Yeah, and we can talk about this later on about, yeah, because I've definitely got things to respond to about what you've just said.
Awesome.
But the catalysts, it was a gradual thing. And that's what I was saying by saying a lot of people seem to, you know, ask me, how do I get to where you are? For me, it was a gradual, it was an accidental thing.
An accident.
And it started in 2007.
Okay.
Yes, 2007.
All right.
2007, there was an accident. And the accident was that I met the team from Czech Games Edition and I started chatting with them. So 2006, a game came out called Through the Ages. Uh-huh. That was not technically CGE's first game. It was actually a company called CBG, Czech Board Games. And they came to Essen with this new Civilization-style card game. I refer back to my previous comment about Civilization-style games.
Yes.
And then what happened is the company split into two. CBG went one way and CGE was formed. And CGE then came back to Essen in all future years. Anyway, I went back to Essen in 2007 and I met up with the team from CGE. And I said, and I met Vlaja and I said, oh my God, Through the Ages, I love the game. This is great. Yep. And I chatted with them and got to know them. I bought Galaxy Trucker, which came out in 2007. I bought League of Six, which I think also came out in 2007. And I played those games. And then 2008 came and I went back and I played their games and I loved their games. And then 2009, I think 2009 is probably where maybe there was the first inkling of it that I went to Essen and I chatted with them and I said, look, I'm a huge fan of your games and your company and I like what you're doing. If there's ever any kind of help that I can give you, like, you know, showing these games off to people in the UK or even just helping you playtest these games or anything like that, I'd be well up for it. I'd be very, very interested. And they went, yeah, sure. And then nothing happened. And then about a year later, I sort of said it again. And they said, oh, yeah, maybe we can send you some stuff. So what actually happened is about a month before Essen, they would send me the print files of their game, a prototype, or maybe 2 months before or something like that. They'd send me all of these PDFs. And I'd literally spend 2 days of my time printing out all of these PDFs, sticking them onto card, making them up, cutting out all of the cards, doing all of this, and basically playing the game. And they said, did you play it with your friends? And I said, yeah. Did you enjoy it? Yeah. We didn't have any proper, what I would class as playtesting feedback for them, other than, yeah, we enjoyed this game. This was good. Because at the time, I didn't, you know, first of all, the games were great anyway, because Vlaja designed them. But also, I wasn't a professional playtester at the time. I didn't know what people were looking for or anything like that.
Sure.
But then they'd send me the PDF of the rulebook while they were working on the rulebook, and I'd read through it, and I'd have a couple of comments on it, and I'd say, this sentence, I don't quite understand what this sentence is saying. Oh, right, okay, we'll reword it. And that was the very start. It was simply me being so passionate about games, finding a publisher that was creating games that I loved. And I got to know the people there and really enjoyed what they did and thought, I want to help out more. If I can, for me, that would be great because all of a sudden, Paul's helping out with a games company. And I wanted to do it just for the love of doing it. And I actually did it with a couple of other publishers at the time. And this went on for years. Sure. So I had a full-time job. I was an IT manager in, you know, a university. But in my spare time, what I was doing, my passion, was I was helping out game publishers with doing various bits of, you know, playtesting or whatever. I'd print out all of their games, take them to events, show them to people. I'd be doing all of that stuff. And it was purely because I just wanted to. And then it was about 2 years after that that every year Czech Games Edition get together for 4 days in March, and they have this event where they invite loads and loads of friends to come and playtest their potential new games for the year.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So all of the new games that CGE will be creating in the year, they will have a whole bunch of ones to test, and they don't generally make a decision about what's going to be their next game until after this event.
Right.
And Vlada Shevatil and Petr Murmak, who's the CEO of Czech Games Edition, sat me down and said, we want to have a meeting with you. And I'm like, uh-oh, my anxiety kicks in. What have I done wrong and everything else? And they sat down and they said, so for the last few years, you've been doing all of this stuff for us. And I'm like, yeah, it's great, isn't it? This excited kid. And they're like, but this is like, how, you know, they said, roughly evaluate how many hours a week do you think overall you're doing this stuff for us? And it was like, well, I don't know, because sometimes it's a lot. And then I went to this entire convention and I spent 3 days demoing dungeon pets to people, you know. And they said, right, well, we can't have this carry on anymore. We cannot continue to do this. It's not fair. We need to pay you.
Amazing.
And I'm like, what? I don't want paying for this. I'm doing it because I want to do it. And they went, no. What you're doing a job. You are effectively doing a job. We value that job and we want to pay you, and we're not going to accept you. We're not going to allow you carry on doing this unless we pay you. So how much do you want being paid? And I'm like, what? This caught me completely by surprise.
Of course.
But ultimately, so they have this timesheet system, and they added me into this timesheet system where I could log all of the hours that I was working and what project it was on and what it was that I was doing. And we came up with an hourly rate, which was just a nominal fee. And that was it. And I started doing it. That was a very, very important point, because go on from there, 2 years later, and my job starts to fall apart. I'm starting to have lots and lots of issues in my workplace, and things are starting to get a bit out of control. And I'm finding, wait a minute, I've got this other source of income. It wasn't very much, but it was another source of income from something that I love doing, that the people I'm doing it for say I'm really good at it, and I was getting better and better at it, that I thought, I wonder if I can actually start charging other publishers in order to do a similar thing.
And when was that? Was that around 2011 or so?
Ish. Yeah, sometime around there. It would have been around 2011, 2012, something like that. So there was a couple of other publishers that I did little bits for, but again, still had a full-time job.
Of course.
My plan was, because I was starting to really hate this job and there was all kinds of issues and HR were involved and there was problems with my boss and everything else. And my whole plan was, right, I'm gonna retire when I'm 50. Retire with, well, I'm doing quotes. You can't see it because we're a podcast.
Yeah, of course.
But I'm doing quotes in the air. Retire at 50. In other words, give up the job and do board game stuff. That was my plan. Yep. However, the job got worse and worse and worse and worse. Mm. And in the end, I just went, yeah, I can't do this anymore. So I decided to create gaming rules at roughly the same. It wasn't because the job was going wrong and I knew that I needed to leave. It was because I was starting to do work-related stuff for like three or four publishers. Now, my wife is an accountant.
Yes.
As an accountant, she has to do everything. She's not an accountant that, oh great, she's an accountant, that means we can fiddle some money and write things off and no. It
no,
means everything
not.
Has to be done exactly right. And she said,
I'm married to a lawyer.
Yeah. Oh right. Okay. She said, if you're gonna do this, you need to create a limited company, and the money that you're earning needs to go through that limited company, and we need to pay proper taxes and proper accounts and proper everything else. And I said, oh, okay. So we created Gaming Rules Limited. So it's Gaming Rules !Limited. The exclamation mark is actually part of the official company name, which is interesting because when you're putting it into some websites, they don't accept
special
characters.
Of course. Yeah.
So Gaming Rules Limited was actually created, and I spoke to my employer at the time and I said, look, I also have this other company because I'm doing side work. And they said, well, that's fine, as long as you're declaring it to the tax man and everything else, which I was.
Of course.
But within a year or two, the job had absolutely crumbled and fallen apart. So I said, right, I'm gonna leave. And thankfully, my employer at the time was going through a series of voluntary redundancies where they basically said, look, we know we're going to be in trouble in 5 years' time financially. So if anybody wants to leave, we'll give them a bit of money and they can go. And my hand went straight up.
Straight up.
And they went, oh, right.
Yeah.
And that, it was almost perfect to the month.
Amazing.
And that was my safety net. So effectively, I got like 4 or 5 months' salary from that old job. And I said to Vicky, I said, right, we've got 6 months. I've got 6 months' salary from the old job, which will probably keep us going for 12 months because it was a good job.
Beans on toast goes a long way.
Yeah. Within that 12 months, I'm going to try and do gaming rules as a proper full-time thing. And if it doesn't work out, then we know we've got this safety net. And for the next 10 years, I didn't have a day off. So, yeah.
And do you remember what Vicky said when you told her you were going to make a living out of board games?
I don't actually know. I'd need to ask her what she thought. Remember, I'd already been doing this a couple of years as a low-paid part-time on-the-side thing. She knew I was passionate about it. I don't think that she realised how it would end up 10 years later. I didn't realise how it would end up 10 later. My life now is not what I thought it was going to be 10 years ago. It's been more of a success than I ever imagined it would be.
And so the retirement in air quotes at 50, how did that work out for you?
I basically got to it 44. But the whole retirement thing is a funny thing because you talk to people, and I'm of the age where I know other people that are retiring, and they say to me, would you ever retire? And I'm like, well, I don't think I ever will. Not in the traditional sense of retirement. When your job is your passion, is your hobby, and even if you take aside the paid work that I do, a lot of the streams that I do are not paid for, they're not sponsored. Am I going to stop doing them? Hell no. You know, I'm a board gamer. This is it. So there's a long answer to when the shift happened from a normal working 9-to-5 job to the career of gaming rules. But it is a long story.
Well, thank you for sharing it today. I guess my next one is, tell me about the launch of Gaming Rules and what your early learnings were or things you look back on now and see maybe you could have done differently. I mean, do you remember your very first YouTube video? Do you remember the first one?
Yes, I do.
Because I looked it up yesterday. You have 1,300 videos on YouTube.
Wow. Do I?
You do. And do you remember the very first one you ever recorded?
I do. Well, that's a trick question.
Okay.
Because there is also a Paul Grogan YouTube channel.
I think I knew that.
And there are two or three videos on that Paul Grogan YouTube channel. The first one of which is me doing a solo playthrough of Mage Knight.
Right.
So my personal...
4.5 hours, is it?
It's something like that. My first ever personal video on YouTube is me playing solo Mage Knight.
Wow.
But that was just on the Paul Grogan YouTube channel. At the point I decided I wanted to do Gaming Rules was... And what the catalyst of what led to it is I have always loved imparting knowledge to other people. When I was at school and when I was at college, I wanted to be a teacher. I was doing physics and I was doing... I did physics with a little bit of astronomy, but my entire life plan when I was, you know, 16 to 19 was sure. I'm going to do physics, a degree in physics, and then I'm going to become a physics teacher at a college. That was my plan. I love teaching people things. And even going back to the games that I played when I was, you know, in my teens and 20s, I was the one who got the games. People came around to my house. Paul would teach us how to play a game. So that was always my thing. And... I that's what I effectively am. I've always, you know, I am now a teacher, just in a different
medium.
Absolutely. But I've always loved that the idea of teaching people stuff. So I came up with this idea that nobody had had before, and I would create a YouTube channel where I would literally teach somebody how to play the game. And I was speaking to some friends of mine about this, and I said, I've got this idea, and this is what I'm going to do. And they said... What, you mean like Rodney Smith?
Yeah.
And I went, who's Rodney Smith? So I then went away and I looked up and I went, literally exactly that. So it was my idea. I wasn't aware that Rodney had already done the same thing, but a few years earlier. But yeah, that was the idea that I had. So what I did is a bit of an experiment. I thought, right, I'm going to make one. I'm going to pick a game And I am going to create my a tutorial video for that game. And the first video on the Gaming Rules channel is how to play Tashkalar.
I don't even know that game.
That is what I created. Wow. Yeah, it's a game by Vlady Shervatel, and it's from 2000 and... don't know, can't remember, 13-ish. Yep. But I basically created it and showed it to Vlady, and he was like, wow, and you made this? And I said, yeah, it took me 4 months. 4 months for like a 12-minute video, because I was learning After Effects. I've got no background in filming, no background in video editing, no background in anything whatsoever. I basically taught myself from scratch.
Yeah.
And I showed him this video and he was basically like, and that wasn't paid for. Even though I did paid work for Czech Games Edition, that wasn't paid for, because that was something I wanted to do as a, I'm going to try and do tutorial videos. That is what I'm thinking of doing. Mm-hmm. And I created that and showed that to him. And he was like, yeah, this is really good. You could probably do this as a paid job. So I was like, all right, okay, let's do it. And then started putting the feelers out for various other publishers to basically start creating tutorial videos. And that's how it started.
Amazing. And to be fair, I think your demo and Rodney's demo don't have a lot of crossover. You know, Rodney seems to focus more on a lot more lighter games. You're more heavy Euros. I mean, Rodney's not going to be doing a 5-part Aeon Trespass video anytime soon.
Yeah.
But...
yeah, I think that's come from, you know, I like those kind of games myself. I'm not sure Rodney does like that kind of games himself. And over the years, I think the hobbyists, the publishers and the industry has gone, okay, we have a Vital Lacerda complexity of game. We know Rodney's going to get 10 times as many views and all of the engagement, but is he going to do it? No, he's not going to do it. He's simply just not going to do it. Who else do we know who makes videos?
Yep, we know a guy. So thank you, Paul. My next question, I guess we're going down a more, I guess, serious and deeply personal vent here. So I appreciate you taking this particular question, is that, you know, ethics and accountability are two pillars that really underpin all your content. And for anyone who watches you regularly or is a consumer of your content, I think that's really clear and transparent and not overt. It's not in a way that is... inappropriate in any way, shape, or form. But I think what comes through in your content is that these two things, and I guess I keep circling back to that ethics and accountability, both in what you do, but in the board game industry broader, is so deeply important to you. And I guess what I'd like to unpick is, where does this come from for you? Where did this originate in the Paul Grogan origin story? Because it doesn't come easily. You know, it's not something that often comes early in life, and it certainly doesn't come easily, and it certainly doesn't come without a fair bit of maturity. If you're happy to, I'd love to share with the listeners where this deep-seated passion for these two sort of pillars of character have come from.
Mm. Well, I'm glad, in a way, that it is very noticeable. I didn't think it was as noticeable as you've made out. I thought I was able to sort of hide it a bit, but clearly not.
I think when you're in a position of influence, it's not something that should be hidden. And I think it's a rare and courageous thing.
So, where does it come from? I mean, this could be an entire hour's podcast about... there are a few things that sprung to mind when I was listening to you asking that question, which... have made me not blush, but actually made me feel a little uncomfortable on the inside, only because I've never actually thought about this. Because it's not just about me saying, oh, I want to do this. It's about, I'm 54 years old now. What makes me me? You know, what things have happened in my life that have instilled this into me? And there are a few things. So I will now tell you things that I don't think I've spoken to many people about. So I've not always been a good person. I'm not saying that I have committed mass murder or anything like that, but over the years in my past, I have done things which I am not proud of, and realized as I eventually got through life and, you know, grew up and things like that, that those things are not right. I have a number of life regrets and things that I'm not proud of in my past. And the more I can do that's a good thing, then, you know, karma might end up paying me in return. I don't know. I just feel bad about things that I've done in the past, which are potentially not good things. Now, I have to caveat this with, I'm not a religious person. I don't have any real religious beliefs. I don't believe that I'm going somewhere when I die and somebody's going to judge me. That's not why I'm doing it. I'm doing it because I believe everybody should be a good person while they're here, and it matters. A very famous wizard once said, all that we have to decide is what to do with the time that's given to us.
Absolutely.
And that is a very important line in life, because every day you make a decision about what it is that you're going to do. And essentially, you could do this or you could do that. And I don't believe the decisions I make are going to have any impact on me when I'm gone. When I'm gone, that's it.
Yeah.
It's not about me setting myself up for a living on a better plane of existence. It's more about doing what I do now. Also, going back to the religion thing,
yes.
When I was in my teens, I was around a lot of very religious people who were friends, and then friends of friends. And because they were friends, you know, we allowed them to not try and influence us, but there was some level of influence going on. Sure. And I was kind of pushing back against that. And the reason why I was pushing back against it is that I knew that some of these people were doing things that were not things that somebody should do of that, you know, religion. And the more and more I got to know these people, he's like, oh, well, yeah, he's a Christian and he goes to church every Sunday, but he's having an affair.
Sure, yeah.
Or he's stealing things from his place of work, or this, that, and the other. And I sort of started building up my own impression that your choice of religion doesn't mean you're a good person. And I hope I'm not upsetting anybody by saying this, but
you're certainly not upsetting me, Paul. I'm an atheist.
Good. Right.
And,
okay.
And as an atheist, you know, I'm of a firm belief that no one holds me to no one holds me to a higher bar than I hold myself. You know, the level of accountability I hold to myself is far superior to anything, anyone, any being, anyone who's looking on from above could ever do so. And that's me.
That's effectively what I'm trying to say. I don't need somebody to come along and say, you shouldn't do that because this person or this book says it's wrong.
Yeah.
And I want to have my own ethics and my own accountability and
absolutely
my own beliefs of what I believe is right and wrong without anybody telling me what is right and wrong. So, yeah, so that's me. That's the makeup of me and where I now am. Now, we translate that to where I am now.
Yes.
And the fact that I don't use massively clickbait headlines and, you know, descriptions in videos in order to get more views. You know, I don't do my channel to get views. I'd love to get more views than I do. Anybody would.
Of course.
But my driving force in this, in my channel, is not, right, I'm going to make a board game channel, I'm going to get 100,000 views per video, I'm going to make thousands of pounds a month from advertising revenue on YouTube, and the way I'm going to do that is I'm going to do this, this, and this. I'm like, no, I just want to teach people how to play games. That's what I want to do. I'm not driven by some of the things that I see driving other people. And that irks me in a way.
Sure.
Now, there's not many content creators. 99% of content creators are doing it because they are gamers and they love the hobby and, you know, they're driven by just wanting to create content. But there are a few content creators out there who deliberately do it in order to generate views, which generates revenue, which generates interest and things like that. And over the years that I've been in the industry, there are so many things that I've heard about. And not just stories, but
of course
things that have been confirmed by multiple people that are unpleasant. And they're not things that I can share in public.
Of course.
Because some of those things are actually from big popular channels. And it's just, you know, for example, running contests, but then not actually giving the games away.
Yes.
So in other words, doing videos where we say, right, we're giving away all of these games, and they generate loads of views, loads of engagement, loads of support, loads of everything else. And then ultimately, at the end of the day, don't actually send the games out.
Yeah.
This has happened a number of times.
Yeah, and for the listeners out there of OMC, please, you know, note that if you're reading between the lines, this is an example that Paul can share, and I think he's being very open and candid in sharing this sort of very surface example of the kind of behavior he's talking about.
Yes. But there's all sorts of other things, and it just really, really bothers me. Because I would never do anything like that. No. And I don't believe anybody should do anything like that. And it just doesn't feel right. So I'm driven by this. Seems very similar to you, an ethical code of conduct and a level of accountability, which I have set for myself because I believe that that's the right thing to do. And that's what I want to do. One of the big things that I have on my channel is that I give all of my advertising revenue every month to charity. I always have. Yes. Every penny from every video goes to charity. Most people think I'm completely crazy for doing that. And I've had, you know, Richard Ham, Brado, say, why do you do this? You don't need to do this.
Yeah.
You should just take the money for yourself. That's your money. You've earned it. You know, nobody else does this. And I'm like, but I don't need to. I'm financially in a position where I don't need that extra money. And you cannot put a price tag on the good feelings I have every single month where we go, there's a charity, we're going to give them £500.
Absolutely.
But I have to say at this point, the only real reason why I can financially afford to give all of my advertising revenue to charity is my Patreon supporters. Gaming Rules started off as a non-Patreon channel. It was just paid work from publishers. But then over the years, I decided to launch a Patreon campaign in order to help justify the time that I was taking off from the paid work to do some of the other content. Because what I was having to do, whenever I did any kind of vlog or any, did I get kind of any review video, those were not paid for, but I was having to take time away from my work in order to do them. And lots of other channels had, you know, crowdfunding, Patreon or whatever. So I thought, okay, I'll start my own, and that will help me feel better about the time that I'm taking away from the paid work. It won't feel as weird to go, literally, I'm taking time off the paid work to do this non-paid work. Anyway, the Patreon over the years has been way more of a success than I ever thought it would be. We touched on the fact that there's a Patreon community, which is very rewarding and phenomenal. And right now I have over 1,000 Patreon supporters. The financial benefit of having 1,000 people every month give me a few dollars means that I can give all of my advertising revenue to charity. If I didn't have the Patreon support, then yes, I would need that ad revenue as part of my income. But the fact that the Patreon support is so good and way exceeded my expectations, it gives me the flexibility to do that. So I just wanted to say a huge thank you to, you know, not just everybody who watches my videos, which helps raise money for charity, but my Patreon supporters that give me the financial flexibility to be able to do that.
To be honest, if you hadn't mentioned the fact that you give all your advertising revenue to charity, I certainly would have, Paul. I think as I keep saying, a consumer of your content, it's something that speaks very highly to your character. You know, and I think that there are probably a number of places that character construction has come from in your life.
Thank you. But yeah, I mean, going back to the, and it's interesting that we're doing this now, because if we did this 5 or 6 years ago, you would be getting different answers from me.
Sure.
But as I've turned 50, I've lost my mum, the harsh reality of the fact that we're not here forever has eventually hit home. And, you know, I'm not going anytime soon, but I am going. At some point, I will be saying goodbye.
Yes.
And for me, again, from a non-religious point of view, when I go, I want to be able to look back and feel that I've made a difference and done some good stuff.
Of course.
And you cannot put a price on that.
No way.
So as I say, you know, the fact that sometimes we give £500 to a big charity and they might send an email and say thanks, right? Sure. Because they've just been given £500 and they make $1 million a year.
Of course.
And sometimes we send £500 to a little charity and they write to us and they go, this has made a massive, massive difference.
Yeah.
You know, and they tell us in detail. And as I say, you can't cut. So maybe I'm doing it for selfish reasons. This is like that episode of Friends where they try and convince Phoebe that there's no selfless acts. You know, I feel so good from doing it that maybe I'm doing it just to make me feel better.
Yeah.
I don't know. I need, you're not my therapist, are you? No. So
not today.
We'll leave that for another time.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Paul. It was a remarkable, amazing and candid insight. And thank you so much for sharing that. It's more than I could have ever hoped for when I asked the question, to be honest. And I guess we'll lighten it up a little bit now. And I guess what I'd like to know and share with everyone is, who were your early influences in the industry of board game personalities, designers, developers, or other influencers?
It would have been, definitely people like Vlaja.
Yeah.
Not both from a, you know, I love his designs, I love his creativity, and I love, you know, what he's done, but also getting to know him as a person.
Sure.
And becoming friends with him and things like that. So very, very influential.
Yeah.
He basically, you know, he was the one who sat me down and had that meeting and said, we can't let you carry on doing what you're doing without paying you. So, you know, that was a big turning point for me.
Yes.
I'm trying to think back to some of the people who...
I mean, being involved with Vlaj is huge, and I guess you've been involved with a lot of big names over the years, and a lot's happened in the last 10 years. 10 years is a long time in the board game industry, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the hobby now is very different from what it was 10 years ago, but even 10 years ago, it was still big. Essen was still huge. Even 20 years ago, it was still huge. So there was a lot of publishers out there whose games that I was enjoying and I was playing, and they are probably some of the publishers that I initially reached out to. Now, when I did start Gaming Rules and people started to become aware of it, people were offering me work. And at the time, I was just saying yes to everything because I was just starting the business.
Yes.
And there's a, you know, where we are now is very different. I now turn away a lot of work that I get offered because I can be picky and choosy. And I've got so much regular work coming in from my, you know, normal clients that I don't have to be doing the kind of work that I was doing when I first started, which is a good thing. But yeah, I'm struggling to remember any early influences in the industry. I mean, when I started doing what I was doing, there was the Dice Tower. The Dice Tower did exist at the time, not as big as it did right now.
Yes.
Rado. Richard Ham, Rado, runs through his playthrough videos. I've been a fan of his for a very, very long time. I think what he's brought to the hobby and how much he's done for the hobby has been absolutely fantastic. And
yes. And the fact that he can bring such energy and such passion after so many years of being involved in this, it's
And I'm friends with Richard. Yeah. I've been friends with Richard for years. There was somebody I was talking to the other day, and they went, "Oh yeah, but it's all put on. He does all of that for views." Sure. And I'm like, "No, he doesn't. Just you can't do that. You can't fake it.
No, you can't Richard, fake that energy."
He gets the criticism of he loves every game.
Sure.
You know, oh, he's just being paid to say he loves every game. No, first of all, when Richard started doing his channel, he wasn't charging any publishers anything. He spent years and years and years producing more content than anybody else, and none of it was paid for because he had a financial stability because of his work in his previous industry that he was able to just do what he was passionate about and didn't charge anybody anything.
Yeah.
Then when life changed and he had to move to America and all sorts of other things, that's when he started charging. But for many, many years, Richard charged nothing for any of his videos, and he was one of the most valuable resources out there.
Sure.
And his passion about the games that he likes is absolutely genuine.
Yes.
And I mean,
there's a lot of chatter about, oh, well, he's only ever excited about games. Or is it that he's only really talking about games that he really likes? Because, as you say, you can't fake that enthusiasm. I can't anyway.
Yeah.
You know, and for me, I think he's fantastic to watch. He's effusive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And even on games he likes, he still...
Yeah.
You know, he still give his absolute honest opinions on them.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Paul. I guess my next question is more for my own curiosity, because I think it's amazing. Is, can you tell us how GridCon was born? You know, GridCon is something you run. It's a gaming convention. How was GridCon brought to life, and how did it become a thing?
GridCon. So GridCon is the convention that is organised by myself and Vicky, my wife, and it stands for Gaming Rules in Devon Convention, which is how the name came about. We are no longer in Devon. We've moved from Devon. We're now in Somerset.
Right.
But we've kept the name GridCon.
GridCon doesn't quite resonate.
GridCon doesn't ring a bell. Now, how was GridCon born is an interesting question, because I mentioned earlier that I first went to Essen in 1999. When I came, there was three of us, me, Barry and Diana, and we were all really into board games, and we went to this place called Essen, and we were absolutely blown away. And 2 weeks after going to Essen, I had a games weekend at my little flat in Welling Garden City in Hertfordshire, and I invited all my friends round to play all of the new games that we'd just brought back from Essen.
Awesome.
And that became a tradition. So basically, approximately 3 or 4 weeks after Essen, I would host, and it used to be called Paul's Post-Essen Games Weekend.
Great.
And all my friends would come over and we'd play all of the new games that we brought back from Essen. That was the tradition. Now, in 2007, when I moved away from Hertfordshire and I moved down to Somerset, the tradition continued. And then when we moved in 2009 from Somerset to Devon and we got a bigger house, it carried on. And we just invited more people. And then for my 40th birthday, so it's in July. So GridCon is in November. My birthday is in July. So what happened is in July 2010, I said to Vicky, you know, we do this 4-day games weekend in November where like 25 people come over and play games for 4 days.
Yes.
I want to do the same for my 40th because it's my 40th. It's a special occasion. So she was like, oh, okay, yeah, I'll allow our house to be taken over. And people come over and most of them stay. We have 4 tents in the garden. Awesome. We have people sleeping in the garage, people sleeping in the kitchen. we literally, yeah, so it's absolutely crazy. So we did that for my 40th.
Right.
So, and Vicky said, it's just for this 1 year, right? Yeah?
Yep.
No. So it actually became twice a year, every year. Paul's Post-Essen Games Weekend was in November, and then this big Games Weekend was in July. And that happened for many, many, many years.
Yeah.
The problem was we got to know too many people. I got to know only too many people, and I wanted to invite too many people. So we ended up, initially, it was just Paul invites all his friends round. Then it was like, oh, wait a minute, Paul invites all his friends round and these couple of extra people.
Yep.
Well, it got to the point where if I could have chosen, it would have been 100 people. And I'm like, oh, but I want to invite Tom Heath. And I want to invite this person. And I want to invite this person. And we have limited space because it's our house.
Of course.
So people joked and said, well, the only solution to this is you're going to have to run your own convention. And we were like, yeah, don't be silly.
Yeah.
3 years later,
yeah,
we sat down and we went, it's actually so much hassle having all of these people round. I tell you what, let's look at running our own event.
Yeah.
So we decided to. We ran a small event at a local community centre as a bit of a experiment, and that gradually moved on. And a year later, we did GridCon 1. And we've just, in November last year, we did GridCon 5. There was a little bit of a hiccup during the COVID years.
Of course.
And we're having a meeting about GridCon 6 in a couple of weeks' time. So yeah, it started out as Paul's Post-Essen Games Weekend, and then grew into a convention because I literally had more people to invite than I could fit in the house.
Amazing. And have I got it right? It's about 300 people each year. Too much for your house, clearly.
It's 300 people. Yes. It was 220 for the first two because we were at a different venue. But we've been at the same venue for GridCons 3, 4 and 5. And 300 people is pretty much the capacity.
Awesome.
And we're happy with that. It gives it a nice feeling of not being too big. And the other nice thing about it, and we'll touch a little bit more on this later on, but there's a high proportion of attendees that are patron supporters of mine.
Yes.
And the great thing with the patron supporters is that they've got a community. So because I have a community Slack channel where these people talk to each other regularly, they've become friends. And it's really nice to see at GridCon, yeah, sure, people are turning up and playing games, but people are turning up and either meeting each other for the first time after becoming friends with them online, or meeting up with them again after meeting with them last year.
Yes.
And, you know, this year we had four people come over from America last year. Wow. We had somebody come over from Kuwait. We have the Maltese contingent come over every year. We've not had anybody from Australia visit yet, but yeah, we do get people coming from all sorts of different places. It's really nice.
Well, my wife lived in England for 7 years, so I may have to hop online and see if I can secure one of the magic passes to get myself over there, because it sounds like a fantastic time.
Well, that's the thing. So patron supporters do get early access to the tickets, but not all of them. There are a certain number of tickets that we do hold back for the public. And last year, when we put the tickets up for sale, they went in under 4 minutes. So the remainder of the tickets that were left sold in less than 4 minutes.
Amazing. I don't like my chances, but I guess we'll see what the fates have in store. So I guess my next question for you, Paul, is, you know, you've likely had a number of bucket list experiences in your decades of involvement. I can imagine, you know, if you get your start with someone like Vlade Kavadl, I mean, where do you go up from there? And you basically rub elbows with all the who's who are in board games. I mean, I was lucky enough this last year at a conference here in Australia to cross paths with Ian O'Toole, who's one of my absolute all-time favorite board game artists, you know, and I love Vitaly Cerda's games. Being able to sit down at a table and play a game with Vitaly Cerda is certainly on my personal bucket list of things to do board game related, you know, in the coming years. You bump into and work closely with board game royalty on a daily basis, and I guess, you know, have you got some bucket list items that you are happy to talk to or describe for us? Maybe one story that comes to mind, or, you know, is it all fairly mundane for you at this point?
I wouldn't have said mundane, but I would say that it's really weird. And again, looking at myself from the outside, I would be slightly envious, and I would not completely understand how you're able to just, you know, get contact with the real big celebrities, your Vlade Kavadls, yes, your Vitaly Lacerdas, you know, people like that, who I have over the last 10, 15 years built up a personal and professional relationship with, that I can just chat with them.
Yes.
People like Ian O'Toole, people like Matt Leacock. And what's really weird is that it doesn't feel weird at all.
Sure.
And I will go to Essen, and I will be wandering around the halls of Essen in the little time that I do have to myself, and a couple of friends will join me, or a couple of patron supporters will come with me and they'll join me, whatever. And I'll bump into Matt Leacock, and I'll go over and I'll say, oh, hi, Matt, how you doing? Chat, 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 whatever. And my friends are stood there absolutely mouths agape, stunned.
Of course.
And they're like, but that's Matt Leacock. And I'm like,
he's royalty, the board game royalty.
And exactly. And for me, oh, I've not seen him for a couple of years. Have a chat. How you doing? Yeah, all good. And that's it. And then wander off. And to me, there's nothing. It's really weird situation.
Sure.
That you can, I know these people, they're approachable, but from most other people's perspectives, they wouldn't even dream of going up and speaking to them and talking to them. So I have lots and lots of situations. I don't have any situation, I don't think, like you've mentioned. You know, I have met people.
Sure, but also you have. I mean, you know, you've play-tested Vitaly Cerda's board games with Vitaly Cerda. And for me, that's something that I would absolutely, not so much play-testing, but to get at a table and sit down and play, say, Lisboa, which is one of my favorites. I mean, I absolutely love Lacerda's games. I think everyone's a masterwork. You know, they don't all resonate with me, but
well, you need to get yourself to GridCon.
Sure.
Vitaly has been at, he's been at every GridCon.
Yes, I do.
He's a special guest at GridCon. He comes, he plays his games with people, he teaches them, and he always teaches them. He's always playtesting his next game. So his next big game, which is the Great Library.
Yes.
He spent 3 days at GridCon 5 demoing that to people.
Yeah.
Whereas last year he was demoing Speakeasy.
Speakeasy, that's right.
So yeah, so you need to come to GridCon, because then you'll get to play his game from next year.
Well, I'll see if I can get one of the tickets in the 4 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So is there anything on a bucket list? What does a current bucket list item look like for Paul Grogan in board gaming, if there is one?
But as far as... I don't think I do. I honestly don't think that I do. There isn't anything like what you've mentioned that I think, oh, this is definitely something I want to do. There was a very special moment for me at Essen Just Gone, where I got to meet the designer of ISS Vanguard and Tainted Grail.
Oh, yes. Good games.
Now, I've worked with him professionally. I worked on the rulebook for ISS Vanguard, and I also worked a bit on Tainted Grail as well.
And can I just pause you there and say the rulebook for ISS Vanguard was a triumph. I played the tutorial missions, which guided me into the scenarios, and I don't think I had to look at the rulebook more than once or twice more through the entire campaign. So a high five on that one.
Thank you. Thank you. But I've worked with him for years, and I've got to know him a bit, and I've chatted with him a bit, and I'm a massive fanboy. Tainted Grail and ISS Vanguard, from a story, narrative, immersion point of view.
Definitely.
Give me the shivers.
Yes.
That's how good they are.
Amazing narratives, unparalleled.
Right. I got to meet him for the first time at Essen this year, and I got to try out Lands of Evershade, which is his new game, and he taught me how to play. And I was... That was a bit, and you know, I'm just glad I've met him, because I've worked with him and spoken to him for a few years, and that was my actual chance to meet him in person, and that was really nice for me. But no, nothing that I can think of on my bucket list of, yeah, I've had lots and lots of experiences. You know, this year's Essen just gone. Civolution was talked about.
Oh yes.
And Ian O'Toole contacted me in, I think, July. Or August, no, probably July, and said, Paul, you need to teach me how to play Civolution at Essen. And I'm like, well, okay, I've known Ian for many, many years. I've never actually sat down and taught him a game. Sure, let's do this. But let's not just do this like in a private room somewhere. I'll contact the publisher and we'll arrange this as a special event.
Amazing.
So we did. So I got Ian O'Toole, David Turksey, and then... I put out an invite to my Patreon supporters. One of my Patreon supporters who was going to Essen would win a seat at the table, and one of them did. And I ran a three-player game of it at the Deep Print Games booth. Stefan Feld came over, said hello to everybody.
Wow.
And it was great. It was
Yeah, of course it was.
Now, I didn't charge for that. That wasn't a chargeable thing. So that was effectively a PR event that helped publicise the game. But I'm not going to charge for that. You know, it was a great thing. I really enjoyed it.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I guess that leads into, what's next for gaming rules? Paul, is it rinse, repeat? Is it more of the same? Is there something, some new direction you'd like to take it in?
More of the same. There are no big plans. I've got plans for this year. And there are things that I want to do this year that I've done differently from last year. And there are things that I want to change in the way that I'm doing things. But that's more about me and my personal time and, you know, the running out of time to get things done that I want to get done.
Of course.
And the being constantly frustrated by not having enough time to do the things that I want to do. Which is why I took the week off in July for my birthday to slowly start chipping away at some of those things that have been annoying me. But that week off was nowhere near enough. So more of those, more time off from the paid work in order to do stuff that I actually really want to do. It is a frustration. It is literally looking at games like the solo campaign for Australia or Earthborn Rangers or Primal the Awakening. These games, these are great games. I want to play these games.
Yeah.
And months and months and months go by and I'm like, it's not happened yet. And I'm like, well, no, it's not happened yet because you've not made it happen.
Yeah.
I somehow have to create a time machine to give me the time to do it. Now, that's not going to happen. I've tried. I've failed.
Yeah.
So instead, I just need to be either more efficient with my time or something. I need to make these things happen because I want to do them.
Yeah, so we touched on that earlier when you were talking about, you know, the everyman board gamer wanting to be Paul Grogan, and I expressed a very slight... not so much distaste, but I guess a rejection of the notion.
Yes.
And here we are.
Well, let's pick up on that now, because this is something that you did mention earlier on.
Yes.
You, when you were talking you gave the impression that at least half of the games that I'm playing for the channel, I don't actually want to play.
Yes.
And that it is a job.
Yes, and perhaps the fraction or the percentage may be not correct, but for me, I need to play what I want to play when I want to play it.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I see that sacrifice that you make with gaming rules for all of us in playing what you have to.
Yeah.
And that's a real thing.
Yes. Yeah. That's the weird thing. I take time off from my job of producing board game videos.
Yes.
In order to produce board game videos.
Yes.
And it's
and so as a board gamer, not just the voice of gaming rules, but as a board gamer, how do you find the that balance is hard.
Yes, exactly.
And so how do you...
So...
Yeah, talk me through that.
Yeah, the thing that I wanted to mention is that I'm now at a stage with the channel where I am, in general, only accepting sponsored work for games which I am interested in.
Amazing.
Now, sometimes it doesn't work out. Sometimes a publisher will contact me about a game and I'll go, oh, that actually looks really interesting. I'd like to cover that on the channel. And then I cover it and I didn't like it.
Sure.
And that, you know, I can't spend 8 to 10 hours reading the rules and watching other videos to decide whether it's a kind of game that I'm going to cover on the channel or not. I have to have a quick look at it. I will poll my Patreon supporters. I will say, there's this game, the publisher's contacted me about this. What do you think? And if they all come back to me and go, it looks amazing and we want you to cover it, that will influence me. If they say, never heard of it, looked at it, doesn't look very interesting, I might not cover it. But a lot of the games that I'm covering are games which I am actively interested in myself. And most of the games that I'm covering at the moment are because I want to cover them and I enjoy covering them. The difficult for me is having to say no.
Yes.
Because I haven't got the time to games that I really want to cover.
Of course.
And that is just down to the fact that all these games are coming out. You know, for example, in a couple of weeks' time, I am going to be covering the new version of Puerto Rico, the Super Deluxe version from
Awakened Realms. Yeah.
From Awakened Realms.
Yes.
Now, I've played Puerto Rico 350, 400 times. I love the game. I think it's absolutely fantastic. It's one of my favorite games of all time. So when Awakened Realms reach out to me and say, Paul, would you like to do some sponsored coverage of this game in January? And I'm like, but I'm busy in January.
Yep.
I mean, literally, I'm full. But A, it's Puerto Rico. B, it's Awakened Realms, who I have a very good working relationship with.
Yes.
I can't say no.
No.
So I've said yes. I've had to shuffle some other stuff around, and I'm probably going to end up having to work a weekend in order to catch up on the work that I'm missing because I'm covering that. But it's Puerto Rico. So I am genuinely excited and looking forward to that game. And that's the great thing about where I am with my work, is that a lot of it is work. But I'm getting to play a lot of games which I absolutely love myself.
Yes. So. I love that. You know, for context, I'm a chef by trade, and I've spent my life, you know, making people happy with food. And that gives me a sense of, I guess, almost a spiritual joy. And when you do what you love, I guess it doesn't really feel like work anymore, even if you've got to layer a little bit more onto it at the wrong time. So I guess, reading between the lines, you know, my next question is, what does the end game scoring condition look like for gaming rules? When do you realize you've won? But it sounds like there is no winning, that it's a game that's just going to keep going and going and...
It's a legacy game.
Yeah.
But with no end condition.
Fantastic.
It's a legacy game with no end condition. Well, there is an end condition, but it's quite morbid.
Yes, yeah. not for this channel.
In terms of when... You know, have I won this game? Yes. I think in some respects, I think whatever the game is, I've definitely won because I've reached a point where, yes, sure, there's stress. And yes, sure, there's things that I'm not completely happy with. But overall, where I am with my life, I feel like I am making a difference. I feel I am providing something that people are enjoying. What I did during the COVID years... which was purely self-motivated and self-driven, is what I did during COVID is that I realized there were a lot of people stuck at home who were not able to work. Some people had lost their jobs. Some people hadn't lost their jobs, but were being paid to stay at home. But from a mental health point of view, they were struggling.
Yes.
And what I did is I basically spent a year doing way more live streams than I normally do. Most of them weren't paid for. So I did less paid work and I just started live streaming more stuff. And a lot of people said that that really helped them through COVID because, you know, at least every day they could join me for an hour and a half or 2 hours or something like that.
Amazing.
So, yeah, feeling like I've made a difference in life and that I've provided something to people is as far as I'm concerned, you know, winning. I have a wife. We don't have kids. We're not having kids. We've got a lovely house. We've got lovely pets. We've just hosted a New Year's Eve party for 14 friends that came over. Vicky spent 2.5 days cooking. It went well. That's winning. I certainly feel very privileged to be where I am, and you know, feel very fortunate to be where I am. I don't think it was down to luck. I think a lot of it was down to, you know, hard work and decisions that I've made that have got me to where I am. Rather than
bit luck, sure.
Yeah. You know, rather than having, you know,
right place, right time,
an inheritance or anything like that. It's nothing like that. I've earned my position of where I've got to, but I feel very proud and happy of where I am.
Amazing. And couldn't agree more, Paul, to be honest. So I guess I have one more question for you that I didn't send through with the with the original list. So my apologies for you know, I guess the surprise. But this is, as a chef, there's something we play at the end of the night, usually when we all get together, and it's often involving a couple of drinks at the end of the night. And our answers will change quite dramatically from night to night, depending on the mood, what time of year, what's happening in our life. But we play a game called Last Meal, where we talk about if you could only have one more meal, for whatever reason. You know, not that it's no morbidity. We're not talking about death, but for whatever reason, you can only have one more meal in your life. What would it be? And so what I want to ask you is, if you could only play one more board game, and that's it, you could only play one more, what would it be?
Oh, I thought you were going to ask me about what my last meal would be.
Oh, well, not today. I want to know your last board game.
Well, it's got to be Mage Knight.
Yeah, good answer.
I mean, Mage Knight has been my number one game for a very long time, and over the last 10 years... so many things have come close. You know, I've got a new game. I've been so excited about this game, and I've gone, oh, could this actually pip Mage Knight for my number one game? And then I let it settle in, and I think about it, and I go, it's very close, but no.
Yeah.
No. So it would be Mage Knight, but one of the reasons why I like Mage Knight is because it is so flexible in playable solo, competitively, cooperatively.
Sure.
Multiple different scenarios, and even if you play the same scenario, it's so varied. And customizable difficulty level, but as you customize the difficulty level, you will score more points. So if you play a game and score 97 points, and I play a game and score 97 points, the fact that I played on a harder difficulty level, it doesn't mean that. The harder the difficulty, the more chance you have of getting. I just think it's a masterpiece of a game's design.
It certainly
so
is.
It would have to be that one.
Well, Paul, that brings us to the end, and I can't thank you enough for sharing your story today. You know, I think it's easy to see from the outside how passionate you are, but getting a glimpse into the inner sanctum, it's been an honor and a privilege. It really has. And your candor, your transparency, and your openness. When I reached out in October, I really didn't expect anything of this sort of, I guess, level of, buy-in from yourself. So my thanks. And the greatest compliment I can pay is that I hope we cross paths again in the future.
I do. Yeah, it's been really good, and thank you very much for the questions that have made me actually think about deeper things in my life, about, you know, not just gaming rules, but why, what it is that makes me do what I do, because that has given me some time for a little bit of self-reflection and just a bit of a pause and look back and go, am I still doing the right thing, and am I happy with what I'm doing, and are there any more changes that I want to make? Because I get so caught up in the rat race of, oh, more games,
yes,
another video, more games, another video. You know, even on New Year's Eve, I was there contacting publishers with, oh yeah, don't forget, you've got to send me the game because I'm covering it the first week in January, and things like this. And it's hard to just step away from that for a minute. And some of the questions you asked have made me do that. So thank you for that.
Well, I'm only too delighted to have had the conversation with you today, sir.
Thank you for having me.
And this concludes our very first episode of Not All Heroes Wear Capes, where I bring to you the people that have brought games to us. My effusive thanks to Paul Grogan for being here today. Here at OMC, we're lucky enough to have a number of remarkable individuals and teams of individuals lined up to come and share their stories with you over the coming weeks and months. And I can't wait to share their stories with you. Peace out, mofos. Away, board games live and die.